Hi, I'm Terry Meekin. Welcome to Roving Report.
Since Richard Aldrich wrote his book, A History of GCHQ, Edward Snowden has come along as a whistleblower and thrown a huge spanner into the works of the intelligence business. To find out where they go from here, and to run us back over the history of GCHQ, I visited Richard Aldrich at the University of Warwick. First up, I asked him what were the origins of GCHQ.
Britain had been breaking code since the Middle Ages. And, you know, the crown heads of Europe had ciphers, but Britain suspended its code-breaking work in the Victorian period and resurrected it really at the start of the 20th century. And I think it's fair to say that most of what we think of as the big triumphs of Bletchley Park were actually also replicated during the First World War.
Who was handling the embryonic GCHQ in the First World War?
Well, it was codebreakers working essentially under the auspices of the Army and the Navy. And gradually they were brought together into this organisation called Government Code and Cipher School. Then at the beginning of the Second World War, there was anxiety about their security in London, real fear of massive air raids and terror from the skies, and that's the point at which they're moved out to the safety of Bletchley Park and the countryside.
And they were still known by the same departmental name in those days, were they? Government?
It was still... Because Government Code and Cipher School was actually a bigger organisation, so essentially the military wing was moved out to Bletchley Park, but the people who worked on diplomatic traffic, some of the really secret stuff, we were still breaking the codes of the Americans, for example, just before Pearl Harbor. That stuff stayed in London.
So there were two sets of code breakers.
So diplomatic code breakers in London, military code breakers at Bletchley Park.
Same intellectual approaches to breaking code, or did they work as a team, or did they have different approaches and one team was more successful than the other?
With the diplomatic code breakers, a few more dirty tricks. So if you're trying to break the codes of diplomats and embassies, paying off the cleaners to bring you the contents of the waste paper baskets is often a very productive way forward. These were called pinches, essentially, where you don't break the code by the sweat of mathematical analysis. You go in through a back door, and many diplomatic codes were broken by pinches or, if you like, black bag burglary. A lot of the work on Bletchley Park, which was military, most famously the work against Enigma, was rather more technical and mathematical. It's where the people like Alan Turing come in, for example.
They applied mathematical logic to the breaking of codes, and then they industrialised it by building machinery to do so.
Absolutely. But of course, at the start of the whole Bletchley Park story, other countries are important. There were keys to the Enigma story, which were given us by the Poles and the French, which gave us our initial way in. And I think it's important to say that we never broke all of Enigma. There were bits of Enigma that we never broke. I think people also don't realise how good the Italians and the Germans were at code breaking. When the British and the Americans got into Italy in 1943 and then began to move into Germany in late 1944, we started to round up German and Italian code breakers, and we were shocked. Churchill was shocked by how well they'd done against our own codes and ciphers.
Were both sets of ciphers and codes in the friendly and the opposition camps equally as complex to break, or were ours easier, do you think?
Our equivalent of Enigma was called Typex. And as far as we know, the enemy never penetrated Typex. But at different levels, there were other systems. So typically, if you're doing codes for convoys, if you're doing mid-level military operations, they use less complicated systems. They're more vulnerable. We now know, for example, one of the reasons the Dieppe raid went so badly, one of the reasons the Germans were waiting for us, Canadian troops fared particularly badly in that episode, was because the Germans had read some of those mid-level naval codes. So the Germans had their own Bletchley Park.
In the 40s, we industrialised the breaking of codes at Bletchley Park with Colossus and those electronic bombs that they made. We carry that forward after the war.
Absolutely, and I think this is also an important moment in terms of the balance of power between Britain and America. At this point, you know, the British and the Americans have signed a number of important code-breaking agreements, which are the foundation stones of the post-war Signals Intelligence Alliance, and we're also beginning to see the phenomenal resources which the Americans are bringing to bear. The industrialisation and the beginning of the computer age.
Are we saying that since 1945 to 50, the British Intelligence Service and the American Intelligence Service have been pretty much hand in glove all the way along ever since then? Have there been breaks in between?
There's a saying in the world of spies, there are no friendly intelligence agencies. There are only the intelligence agencies of friendly powers. The relationship with the Americans and other English-speaking countries, typically the United States, New Zealand, Canada, Australia, has always been close, but at the same time there are things that we don't share. So the relationship with the Americans during the Cold War was very much focused on military signals intelligence about the Russians and the Chinese. But at the same time, GCHQ would not share intelligence with the Americans about typically oil deals in the Middle
East. Economic intelligence.
Economic or even some diplomatic intelligence. And there were large places, large areas of the world, where actually British and American foreign policy was not in agreement. So, for example, Britain had recognised communist China in 1949. The United States had not recognised communist China. So there were significant points of tension. And all the way through the Cold War, the Treasury was always saying to GCHQ, well, why are you duplicating the work of the Americans on, you know, diplomatic traffic for Africa? And the GCHQ will say yes, well, we share some things with the Americans, but it's not in our national interest to share everything.
How much of this is devolved within GCHQ? Can a director say, well, I don't think we should be sharing this with our friends in America? Or is there a strategic political overview or a civil service overview that says, not, you know, tell them this much, but no more?
MI6 and GCHQ work for the Foreign Office. So there's a lot of direction coming from, sometimes directly from the Foreign Secretary, and there's also a department in the Foreign Office called the Permanent Undersecretary's Department, which is essentially like giving strategic direction to places like GCHQ. Around the Second World War, it was always the Cabinet Secretary who kind of had oversight of these things, but by the 1960s, by Harold Wilson's time, it's getting too big. So effectively what you're seeing
is, they've got a seat on the board.
Yeah, so the Cabinet Secretary has a kind of an assistant called the coordinator, and it's normally the head, someone who's previously been a head of one of the agencies, and some of the most effective ones, the guy called Joe Hooper, who'd previously been GCHQ, and then he sits in the Cabinet Office. There's a very secret committee that sits in the Cabinet Office, and it's people like that and the top officials from the Treasury, the Foreign Office, and they're the people who are making the decisions about where we spend our money, who we give our intelligence to. Now, if you were to look for one word to describe British intelligence since the Second World War, it's impecunious, it's short of money. America's got so much money that they can, you know, they can do everything. But for Britain, it's always, you know, if we spend money on this, we can do less of that. And those were the guys who were taking the decisions.
What were the specific challenges for GCHQ externally? Let's say in the 50s, the early 50s, are we talking Cold War era then?
Yeah. All through the Cold War, we struggled to achieve the equivalent of breaking Enigma. Blunt, Burgess, Philby gave some of those treasures.
They were the high-level cleaners. They could get the information
absolutely
with it.
So we didn't have the same degree of success that we had during the Second World War. And sometimes when we had that success, typically in the 1970s, we lost the fruits of that success fairly quickly because it was blown by those agents. Essentially, what GCHQ was doing was looking at mid-level and low-level traffic, not messages sent by Stalin or Khrushchev, but maybe things sent by the Soviet Air Force. And actually, even from that sort of mid-level operational traffic, you can learn an enormous amount about your opponent. And of course, the crucial thing during the Cold War was warning.
The four-minute warning.
Or even, hopefully, 24 hours of warning. Because if the Russians were going to attack us, they would need to open up ammunition dumps, mobilise troops, prepare military hospitals. There'd be different patterns of railway traffic. And GCHQ was... it's rather like a zoologist gets to know an animal. You get to know its habits. And you're looking for little signs of different behaviour. So, you know, the meerkat comes out of its burrow and every morning runs out off to the left. And one morning it comes out of its burrow and it runs off to the right. And if you know your meerkat, means something.
So this, of course, is where your mathematicians can come in, because they can put numbers and quantify all these activities and see where the patterns change and where the patterns are different, and that will flag something up.
And a lot of the work on signals intelligence during the Second World War and during the Cold War was exactly that. You didn't actually need to read the contents of the message to get good intelligence. So there's a sudden spike in the volume of traffic coming out of the Soviet Air Force headquarters, or if traffic drops off completely. We had an enormous war scare in 1969 because Soviet Air Force traffic just disappeared. So for years it had been the same level, the same, and then all of a sudden nothing.
Of course, I suppose that's the same intellectual approach to gathering warnings of attack employed against the fundamentalist threats nowadays. When the chatter, if you call it in the word, changes or increases or the patterns change, that gives you a bit of a smell that something's going on.
Absolutely.
So we're into the 1960s now. Are we taking GCHQ away from Bletchley and putting it and relocating it into Cheltenham?
A little bit of Bletchley Park remained at Bletchley Park through the Cold War. There were always training courses going on, but most of Bletchley Park packs its bags and moves to the outskirts of London in 1946, a place called Eastcote. Stays there until the early 1950s, and then GCHQ moves from that site to Cheltenham in the early 1950s and arrives at the two sites in Cheltenham in the early 1950s and has been there ever since.
Is it still an evolutionary process, same challenges, or is there anything where they've really had to pull the stops out?
One of the challenges in the latter years of the Cold War, all the way from the 1960s and 70s onwards, was that one of the assets for GCHQ was the little bits of residual empire. So although Britain had Hong Kong, Cyprus, Ascension Island, Diego Garcia, quite often you needed to be closer to your target. Quite often you needed just the peculiar atmospherics of a particular region to collect good intelligence. And as we get on through the 60s, 70s, 80s, Britain begins to lose some of those last fragments of empire. So, you know, there's always been controversy over the bases in Cyprus. We lost bases in Sri Lanka. Obviously, in the 1990s, we lost our foothold in Hong Kong. So this gradual pattern of imperial retreat has presented challenges for GCHQ throughout that.
And how have they overcome them?
Well, I guess at the same time, you're seeing a transfer to satellites, a transfer to the internet. But even now, there are overseas locations which are essential for access to cable traffic.
What, still our own territories?
All friendly territories. Some of the Snowden revelations have shed an interesting light on those things.
You talk about the close relationship with the military that GCHQ has. You know, they're sort of subcontractors in that respect. The submarines are listening off the coast and that type of thing.
It's a marriage. And one of the big advantages, of course, during National Service, where there were lots of people going in with languages, great academic ability, and actually if you read the memoirs of people like Alan Bennett, you know, lots of famous people who are now known in other capacities, were part of this army of military people working for GCHQ.
Wireless telegraphy operators.
All that sort of stuff, listening into the Russians in little huts in Germany. And of course, what this also allows GCHQ to do is to hide some of its spending. And even now, the entire British intelligence budget is said to be about £2 billion a year. Actually, I think the real cost of GCHQ alone is probably around $3 billion. But of course, a lot of the things it uses, satellites, submarines,
in other people's budgets,
are not in GCHQ's budget. Mm. So even now, I think that relationship with MOD is very useful. It's useful to MOD, of course, because it means MOD is very tightly plugged in to Britain's biggest intelligence provider.
They're both charged with the defence of the UK, so there should be a seamless operation to a large extent. We used to know who our enemies were. Russia seems to be coming back as an identifiable, difficult opponent, perhaps. We've now got this amorphous fundamentalism, and we've got this controversy about, in order to find out what the chatter is, they could be anywhere in the world. GCHQ's got to look anywhere in the world to find out where it is, and it's been employing technology at a rapid pace to, in order to pick an algorithm of how the world breathes and how the world operates.
The biggest enemy for GCHQ after the Cold War was actually the internet, for both GCHQ and the National Security Agency, because we get to 1989, 1990, the Cold War ends, the politicians are understandably saying, we need to cut defence spending, we need a peace dividend, but actually this was the very moment at which GCHQ and NSA face enormous technical challenges. So, you know, mobile phone use, computer use, internet communications goes from virtually zero in 1990 to a fantastic volume. International phone traffic goes up by about four times over that period. In the meantime, they're having their budget cut. And so essentially, both those agencies slip behind in the 1990s. And then, of course, after the attacks of 9/11, 2001, you suddenly see a new wave of funding and they start to catch up. Terrorism is a symptom, but the underpinning thing is actually globalisation. Globalisation brings with it a whole range of nasties, not just terrorism, but organised crime, people smuggling.
And what's the answer?
Quite old-fashioned. I like countries with firm borders and boundaries because they deliver a certain minimal level of security. Globalisation has delivered enormous economic growth, but with that it requires countries to open up their borders to a free flow of communications, money, people, ideas. That brings some advantages, but it also brings real dangers, and global terrorists and organised criminals love a porous border.
So you're suggesting that we should be moving backwards to putting a really secure fence up and a small gate so we know who's coming in, who's going out, and maybe a trawl of who's actually here.
I certainly think that we enjoy certain advantages in the UK in the sense that we are an island. We do control a lot of our physical and electronic traffic coming in and out of the UK, and retaining control over some of that is important.
Do you think that the role of human intelligence agents in the field is still an important asset for GCHQ, or do you think it's mostly electronic gathering now?
Well, yeah, this is really interesting. If you said to the heads of MI5, MI6, GCHQ, let's merge you all into one organisation, they'd be horrified because they have their traditions and their history and their different way of doing things. But if you were speaking to a room full of people aged 30 who work for those organisations, they'd say, well, in effect, we are merged. We mostly work in joint teams because the differences between human agent work and SIGINT have disappeared because everyone with a mobile phone is a mini Bletchley Park, and sometimes when you're attacking a human target you need the special skills of GCHQ to do that. So increasingly the three agencies and also National Crime Agency Her Majesty's Customs, all these organisations increasingly work in
intermesh. So let's take it on from 2010. What's changed in the world for GCHQ?
I think the big change for GCHQ was a chap called Edward Snowden. And Edward Snowden was actually a contractor. What's interesting is Edward Snowden was created by that attempt to address the problem of the internet in about 1999-2000. The Americans decided to privatise a lot of their backdoor services. They decided to embrace the big internet companies to try and catch up with technology. And as they opened up their back door and privatised a lot of their activity, in walked this chap called Edward Snowden.
Were they actually trying to influence the technological architecture to make it easier for them to access the information that these pieces of equipment carried, or were they just privatising it?
They've always done some of that. They've always needed back doors.
Yeah.
But actually, this was just trying to catch up, trying to ride the wave of Silicon Valley. Snowden is not the first whistleblower. And both GCHQ and NSA are confronting the fact that in the second decade of the 21st century, it's very difficult to protect secrecy. If you're a whistleblower back in the 1970s, you know, if you were someone like Daniel Ellsberg leaking the Pentagon Papers, you needed, you know, 24-hour access to a photocopier and some really big shopping bags. And now you can steal half the secrets of the Western world on a hard drive about the size of my fist.
Mm.
And that's a huge problem.
Well, the answer is not to store it on your
Washington and Whitehall are petrified. The other problem is that Snowden has advertised to the world a whole range of intelligence techniques which many of these countries did not know about. So now Brazil, India, Burkina Faso are queuing up to buy their own donuts, to buy their own Bletchley Parks. And if you talk to people who work in the software industry around this rather dark sort of environment, they're overwhelmed with overseas customers. Snowden was against spying, but actually what he's done is resulted in an explosion of the industry.
We no longer have a unique an operation in the world because all these other countries are getting sons of GCHQ.
And actually, the cyber warfare superpowers are not necessarily Russia and the United States. The strongest cyber warfare power in the world is probably Israel. The second most powerful may well be India, could be Brazil, could be Singapore. So this is radically changing the balance of power in the world. And, you know, GCHQ is having to think about these things.
Cyber attacks aren't just about computers nowadays, aren't they? They're about devices and infrastructures.
In 10 years' time, everything we buy in a shop that costs more than £20 will have an IP address. So your shoes will tell you how many miles you walk today. My fridge will tell me whether I'm running out of cheese. You won't have to watch your handbag. Your handbag will be watching you. So we're going to be in an internet of things. And all those things will be gathering intelligence, but all those things will also be vulnerable to cyber attack.
So really, it's GCHQ's possible job to build in the resilience, or to get people to build the resilience into these devices so that effectively you can pull a plug, a fuse.
One of the biggest revolutions at GCHQ, actually, over the last 20 years, has been in its a protective security division, and essentially becomes responsible for the security of the UK's internet, internet banking, internet commerce. Had to change itself from being one of the most secretive organisations into one of the most outward and public-facing organisations. So an organisation that was originally defending some very obscure government technology is suddenly doing that for the whole country. And given that internet security is a common good, arguably protecting the resilience of that infrastructure for the whole world.
Do they still do what they used to do? Different people look at different parts of the world, different technology. They have sort of a regional desk, an Africa desk, a Far East desk, is it against an enemy desk?
That disappeared in the mid-1990s. Mid-1990s, there was a massive change, because all through the Cold War, people at GCHQ lived in those specialist little huts. You know, you worked for your whole career on Soviet Air Force. From the mid-1990s, I think there was a recognition that many of the threats we now face are joined together, and many of our enemies specifically are people who live in the seams of our jurisdictions. They're country hoppers. They hop from country to country. They exploit globalisation. And that really means at GCHQ, everybody has to talk to everybody. So the mantra now is, you know, we've moved from need to know to need to share. But of course, when everybody's sharing everything, that creates some problems. And of course, when Edward Snowden comes along, he cleans you out.
He's probably done more damage the time he was exposing what was going on than possibly even Prime did in his day when he was a spy within GCHQ.
I think Snowden's a very complicated character. And he shows us that it's now very difficult to have a meaningful debate about our freedoms and civil liberties without at the same time giving away information that helps our enemies.
He probably signed a contractual piece of paper, but in the greater good, do you think he's done more good than harm by actually telling the world what he's told the world?
He's kind of committed some of the sins he's complaining about. So he's complaining about mass surveillance. What he's actually done is mass leaking. So he's leaked a lot of things which actually aren't necessarily very relevant to the debate over individual privacy. I think if Snowden had walked into Congress with a lawyer and revealed specific things that pertained to domestic surveillance in the United States, and there's no doubt in my mind that the National Security Agency was breaking American law at various points in the last decade, I think if he'd focused on that, he would have perhaps been on firmer ground. So, again, he's a complex character. He's revealed some things which are troubling in terms of individual liberty, personal freedom, but at the same time, that information has given some aid and comfort to our enemies.
Was he basically revealing American, the NSA activities, or did GCHQ also get exposed to this?
Oh, an awful lot of GCHQ material was revealed. Because so much of the business conducted by NSA and GCHQ is done jointly. So a lot of those PowerPoint slides have the GCHQ logo on and are specifically about GCHQ.
These rendition sites that the Americans weren't known in for a lot can possibly say that GCHQ, if they didn't break the law, they certainly looked the other way. Because in order to obtain the rendition and the flights out of the UK and that, there has to be official clearance for these things to be taking place. And it's pretty obvious from what Snowden said that some of this stuff did take place on British soil. So the question is, I suppose, do you think GCHQ has broken the law?
It's interesting to see GCHQ shift towards focusing on the law, employing a lot of lawyers themselves, and continually reassuring their employees that they've done nothing unlawful. In some ways, the biggest issue is for the British Prime Minister. If you look at the intelligence fiascos, embarrassments, controversies of the last 20 years, most of them have come from the United States. You know, whether it's WMD, whether it's secret prisons, whether it's interrogation, whether it's Snowden, every
use of torture,
every 4 or 5 years, you know, there's some major controversy, and it's often about cooperation with the Americans, who've gone perhaps one step further than the British would go. And, you know, we go all the way back to the 1950s and the 1960s. These are things which can actually potentially bring the government down.
But it's also hard for an observer to believe that the Americans and the British Secret Services working so closely together, that GCHQ must have known what was happening in perhaps, if we want to call it, illegal activities of the NSA, doing those things. They must have, you know, they've got to facilitate them to get the intelligence themselves, but they didn't actually do it themselves.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think, you know, one of the constant conundrums for not just GCHQ, but MI5 and MI6.
I mean, we've had MI5 agents present at interrogations where the one's been there in strictly illegal circumstances.
They're working alongside the security agencies of perhaps half the other countries in the world. And a lot of these security agencies are not very nice.
No, No, I mean, you've got, there was black sites in Poland, there's black sites in the Middle East, and they don't think about those guys.
Take the French. The French, whose attitude to these things can be very abrupt, can be very... Think about Rainbow Warrior, you know. So, even within the circle of our NATO allies, you know, some of our oldest NATO allies, you're working alongside services which have...
Prepared to be brutal to get the information they want.
To be pretty brutal, actually. So, yes, every day, I think, they're confronted with these sorts of challenges. And it's a difficult world.
Mm.
It's a difficult world.
I don't have an answer, do you?
Well, I think you've mentioned torture, and I think that's one of the lines that should never be crossed. Torture is a symbolic thing, and being very firm on the issue of no torture is not just a pragmatic thing, because torture always does more damage than any benefit that you can gain from it. But it's also symbolic. It's about being a civilized country. It's about saying there are certain values which you stand for. So there are certain lines that I think that should never be crossed.
You've been listening to a special roving report by Terry Meekin on GCHQ, Past, Present and Future, with Professor Richard Aldrich of the University of Warwick, author of The History of GCHQ. Roving reports are produced and presented by Terry Meekin for Community Radio. Community Radio, daring to be different.